for the accusation and why? And especially, was it as random as history says, like a plague? You know, anybody could get it.
A lot of the people had been suspected before, whether they'd been accused formally, like Bridget, but long simmering resentments. But the first three were people near or in the household of the minister in the village, whose daughter and niece were the first to have some sort of convulsions. There was something wrong with them, but we don't know what, really. And they accused the slave woman and the family and a couple of neighbors. And then when the hearings took place, the neighbors insisted they were innocent, and the slave woman is sort of verbally backed into almost confessing. She doesn't quite confess. She's saying she's a victim of all these witches. She's agreeing with it, and they assume she's one of the witches.
I guess my general question for you, Ted, is, can anybody say that the witch trials and accusations were an instrument of power, class power, church power, gender power, you name it?
All of the above. Yeah.
Really?
I think in many ways. Here, realize, though, too, that what's going on in Salem is not unique, right? There's about 100,000 people accused of witchcraft in Europe and her colonies over about a 300-year period.
It's a key point, right.
You know, and frankly, Salem is just a fly speck. By European standards, where in one outbreak you had 2,000 people executed over a 10-year period in the city of Cologne, Germany, Salem is nothing. You know, I don't mean to minimize the loss. One of them was one of my ancestors, but, you know, so you have to realize
that.
Yes, he was too. But he was one of the ones, five people who died in prison, actually, while awaiting trial. But realize then that there's so many forces going on here. You have political uncertainty in the colony. You have lots of anger amongst the people, scared at the war, scared at the perceived sign of Satan being loose in the colony. They're angry. Five ministers and four ministers' wives are accused of witchcraft. Members of the government, what we would call today the state senate, are accused. The governor's wife is accused, the wife of the leading
minister.
But, you
know, your reference to Europe is to me, the key one. The fact that, as I read these stories, it seems to me it's an epic of something that's coming to an end, not something that's beginning. And it happens just to get a toehold on our shore. But somebody's pointed out that in England at the time, John Locke, the great political scholar, Isaac Newton, maybe the greatest mind that ever lived, the side of Johann Sebastian Bach, but I mean, an unbelievable prodigy. They believed in witches.
Of course they did.
Middle of the 17th century, their contemporaries of Cotton Mather, they were as deep into it as he was.
Yes.
Robert Boyle, the great physicist, the founder of physics, is engaged in experiments to see if he can literally prove that witches are real. Because if you doubt the existence of witches, who were created by Satan, and Satan, who's created by God, if you don't believe the witches are real, it's a slippery slope. Do you not believe that God's real?
Oh, my God. Speaking of other odd notes, I think there's a fascinating sort of early fantasy of sort of American exceptionalism in this, too. As Stacey Schiff was just saying, it was a point of pride among some of those ministers that that Armageddon was going to take place right here in Boston, Boston's own, Boston strong, so to speak. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I'm not sure how much the general public was aware of that, but Nicholas Noyes, the minister in Salem, was very interested in the Book of Revelations all along.
But she was saying that they thought it was a badge of honor to have been selected for this ultimate shootout, the end of times.
Well, you had a chance to prove yourself spiritually, certainly.
Right, absolutely. This is the city upon the hill. They have a special covenant with God, and they've been beset with Satan as their great test, and they have to overcome Satan.
They've been trying to do things right, God's way, so naturally Satan would have it in for them. Other people might be too easy a target.
How good were they that they were so good that Satan had to
stop it?
Well, you consider, think about this. You know, they are here to form Winthrop calls the city upon the hill, right? And in fact, actually, the first settlement of Massachusetts is not Boston, the hub of the universe. The first settlement of Massachusetts Bay is Salem. When Winthrop arrives and gives that sermon, he's talking quite literally as well as metaphorically about Salem. It is that shining Christian utopian community. And two generations later, they're accusing each other of witches.
Everybody goes, sorry.
That on a hill part also indicated that everybody was watching the experiment of the settlement to see if they were going to fail or not. So don't blow it.
Everybody goes to Salem now. I want to know where you go in, I mean, literally, street address, to feel the tingle of this story.
Well, the burying ground, burial point. And, of course, the Corwin House, called the Witch House for generations, which is still standing, was the home of one of the judges. So that has a direct tie. I mean, if the walls could talk, those are the walls that you'd hear something. You know, the first period houses that are there and just sort of walking around the geography of it, if you know that a good deal of it's been filled in, like Boston. But once you have the lay of the land in your mind, you can figure out where things happen. You can figure out where the wheels fell off the cart of the miller when he was at odds with Bridget Bishop.
What you feel, though, in those spectacular houses of central Salem is more Hawthorne's world than Cotton Mather's, no?
Well, I think in some ways, but also, too, I mean, to me, it's I get the sense pretty much everywhere. I drive into Salem to work, and I like to drive through Salem Village and come in through the old street by the 17th century houses.
Oh, yeah.
And the site of the parsonage.
It's a little more, it's not rural, it's suburban in Danvers now that was Salem Village. But, yeah, Rebecca Nurse's farm, around it, and there's a house and the meeting house replica.
And the cemetery where she's supposed to be buried, where her family basically stole her body off of Gallows Hill to give her proper decent Christian burial.
Is there an intact cemetery from the period?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Oh, yeah, a couple of them.
All of them.
Yeah.
A number of them, sure.
Oh.
Of course, yeah. So, but also to me, too, is honestly, I get the sense pretty much everywhere, because realize people were accused from Wells, Maine to Sudbury, Massachusetts. People from all throughout Essex County and Boston were involved.
Middlesex County? I mean, the jail in Cambridge was full.
My ancestor, Roger Toothaker, died in the jail in Court Street in Boston.
Did you say Toothaker?
Toothaker. Yeah, he wasn't a dentist. He was a doctor, but not a dentist. He was a doctor.
That's really his name.
Yeah, Dr. Roger Toothaker, yeah.
Who are some of the other players that you fix on? We barely mentioned Cotton Mather or his father, Increase Mather, but both among the perps and the victims, who are your key people?
Marilyn, who do you?
Perps. Well, yeah, it was not Cotton Mather's shining year. He took it, I assume, took it for granted that the judges, who were all older than he was, knew what they were doing. He offered caution. Specifically, they asked, you know, how should we do this? He said, be careful with the spectral evidence. They more or less ignored it.
Yeah, he kept saying, be careful, but then kill them.
Right, but then he says, but you're doing a great job.
If you find a real one.
Right.
And they assumed they had, I guess, and he assumed they knew what they were doing, and he didn't question it enough. And then, of course, his comments when things started to die down, although at the time you didn't know it was over, were unfortunate for his reputation. That was not a shining moment for him, but he was not this stereotyped boogeyman that people make.
He did other a number of other important things in promoting inoculations, for example, and he wrote many famous sermons that are still read. On the other hand, I'm amazed that he could die with that much. I mean, his reputation could survive that much blood on his hands.
Well, but see,
he had some problems with his reputation.
The whole ministry does, right, and the whole colony does, because remember the ministers are the top advisors. His father, Increase Mather, is the top political advisor of the governor. So you have this really a theocracy. As I say, I think that's one reason in the end five ministers are accused of witchcraft is people realize that the ministers are leading them astray. So it's not just Cotton Mather, it's the whole system.
Ted, you spoke of 1,000 pages of court transcripts. I mean, who was writing that stuff? And what are the best scenes in it?
Oh, it's immense. Some of them was actually taken down. Imagine this. Samuel Parris, whose daughters are afflicted, who's the minister in Salem Village, he's taking down some of the court testimony. How would that fly today in our efforts to have an unbiased, unprejudiced court?
Well, he knew shorthand. How many people did?
Right. He was the most literate man in town, so you had the schoolmaster and the ministers write these things down. And they're full of just amazing detail of the accusations. And to me, what's really amazing is some of the details you can see. If you read through the testimony, for example, when I read them carefully, I see things like evidence of domestic abuse, maybe even maybe just even sexual abuse that you can read in these documents. When you have one of the afflicted girls testifying that John Proctor's specter whipped her and beat her, and then Mary Warren, John Proctor's servant, says, "Yes, and I was sitting in the chair, and a specter approached me, and I grabbed him and pulled him into my lap." Mm. Wow.
And then the fever broke in a sort of hurry, and Cotton Mather got a safe distance from the whole thing. How did that happen?
Well, he was asked by the government to write an account of the trials, probably mostly to explain it to England as to why things were going wrong. And he asked to see some court papers, and I don't know who picked them out, but it made the people being accused sound guilty. And he assumed they had been, and he supported what the judges had done, but that's where his reputation really suffers.
Tad, so many of these bad things happen. They stop when they come to seem ridiculous,
right?
Not to mention just too scary.
Sure.
What broke it?
How about when the governor's wife is accused of being a witch? That's when the governor pretty much says, "Enough, enough. You know, this is coming to an end." And he writes to the king, and he says, "You know, I know that people who are not witches have been accused. His wife is accused. His Increase Mather's wife is accused of witchcraft." And it becomes clear that maybe as many as at least 200 or 300 people have been accused or informally cried out upon. Surely not all the good people, not all of our representatives to the general court. I know today we may have some questions about our representatives in Beacon Hill, but certainly they're not all witches then or now.
It's a dangerous world for so many reasons, but don't we all agree that it could never happen again? Certainly not that way.
It would happen differently.
What do you think, Ted?
I think it's happening today.
Uh-oh. Like?
Well, like compare witches to terrorists. We can talk about that if you want.
We will. We will when we come back. We're talking about the Salem witch trials with Marilyn Roach and Tad Baker. The witch trials of 1692. Coming up, history is one thing. The heart's truth, art's truth, can cut even closer. And there's a ton of it out there around the Puritan New England. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. A lot of what we know about the Puritan New England setting of the Salem witch trials is pure fiction, and it's some of the greatest fiction this country has ever produced. The late John Updike honored The Scarlet Letter by Nathaniel Hawthorne as the original American masterpiece. The Witches of Eastwick and Roger's Version were just two of the Updike novels that extended Hawthorne's sexual and theological themes into our day. Here is just a taste of one radio version of another of the Hawthorne masterpieces, The House of the Seven Gables.
The CBS Radio Mystery Theater presents Once upon a time, there was a poor and common man named Matthew Maule, who owned a couple of acres that were desired by a rich and titled man named Colonel Pynchon, who wished to build a house on the property. Since the colonel could not acquire the land by lawful means, he took others. The year was 1650, and he connived to have Matthew Maule declared a wizard, condemned to die on the scaffold, which is where our story begins.
Quiet! 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 You have not heard the last of Matthew Maule. You or your children, or your children's children. In particular, you, Colonel Pynchon, and all the family who follows you. Look at him, everyone, as a dying man makes a promise. Colonel Pynchon, God will give you and yours blood to drink.
Catherine Howe is our guest in the long line of Howes who are descended from the cast of characters in witch-era Salem. She herself grew up in Houston, then returned to the roots for graduate school. By now, she's a very successful young novelist in her own right, who got a critical jolt of inspiration, she says, in an old house that she and her husband had rented in the venerable North Shore town of Marblehead. She told us the essential wisdom of the Salem witch trials is distilled for her in what the great Hawthorne called his romance, that House of Seven Gables.
The House of the Seven Gables is, for me, the signal Hawthorne book. The number of layers that you can peel back is truly staggering.
Remind us of the dark story within
the dark story within the House of the Seven Gables is it is a grand Salem family, the Pynchon family, who have fallen on hard times and have dwindled down to a spinster who's living alone, who then is joined by her somewhat insane cousin after he gets out of prison. And she has been brought to such a point of desperation that she deigns to open a scent shop in her grand family estate. So she thinks very highly of herself. She's very proud. And yet she is destitute. In this thread, there is this kind of Yankee stereotype of, you know, proud destitution. So Miss Pynchon opens a scent shop, and over the course of the story, a bright young character named Phoebe joins them, and there's also a Hawthorne stand-in. There's an artist character who's living in the back who is Hawthorne's proxy throughout the course of the story. But the central question is that the house was built on land that the Pynchons stole from Matthew Maule, his fictional person, condemned as a witch. That Matthew condemned Colonel Pynchon, who stole his land, with this curse: if you take away my life, God will give you blood to drink. Pynchon stole the land, built the grand house, and then choked to death on his own blood sitting in the middle of the house. And so there is a portrait on the wall of this grand patriarch who died because of this curse, and that the idea is that the family's fortunes had been sliding ever since, that there was a pall hanging over the House of the Seven Gables because of the legacy of this injustice, that the injustice itself was built into the walls of the house. And I don't want to give away the twist. I don't know if it counts as a twist. There's a fantasy of lost wealth, which is to say proof of ownership of tracts of land in Maine, which of course was part of Massachusetts in the 17th century, which it turns out, which if only Miss Pynchon could find it, then she could close the scent shop and be restored to her former glory. Well, lo and behold, the deed to the land is hidden in the wall behind the portrait of Colonel Pynchon. So it is literally built into the walls of the house. And so the way that Hawthorne uses the house itself, the house is both a symbol and also an embodiment of shame and of cultural appropriation and of distrust and betrayal. And so there's a tremendous physicality to it. Talking to your point about, you know, what is it about the physicality of the North Shore? Yeah. What is it about the space of the North Shore? I feel like those very questions are at the very center of what Hawthorne is grappling with in the House of the Seven Gables.
You're persuading me that Seven Gables, not the Scarlet Letter, is the perfect distillation of everything we're talking about around witches.
I would say that it is. And Hawthorne was at pains also to point out that he conceived of his fiction not as novels, but as romances.
Yes.
And so Hawthorne's very conscious of the power that fiction holds to innervate certain ideas in history. Which is something that I personally find very interesting. He was writing around the time that history as a field was becoming professionalized for the first time. And if you look at some of the first history books about the history of North America, oftentimes they leave out Salem. Salem had been written out of early sweeping histories of North America and of the United States. And so Hawthorne is very keenly aware of the power that fiction holds to bring a certain approach to history to life. But at the same time, he, like me, like Arthur Miller, is trapped in his own cultural moment and is using this historical event as a lens for his own questions, for his own prerogatives. You can still visit the House of the Seven Gables today. It's such a dramatic sort of space in American literature that it persists as a place that people want to visit and want to see and want to touch and experience. And Hawthorne is an interesting case because he used historical fiction to grapple with his own sense of place and his own sense of guilt and responsibility, his sense of the fact that Salem and that region of the world has been tainted by a miscarriage of justice. And I think that that sense of taintedness or a consistent worry about what Salem means is one of the reasons that people are drawn to visit Salem today. I mean, certainly Salem is the place to go for Halloween. It's a lot of fun and it's a wonderful town. But I think one of the reasons that so many people go to Salem is this desire for physical proximity, as if physical proximity can explain this eternal conundrum of how could American culture, with all that we hold dear about that culture, have allowed this to happen. I think that we keep worrying at that question as a culture, as a society, in history, in literature, in film. And in some ways, the reason we keep worrying about it is because there is no satisfactory answer.
What's the modern moral of the tale of the young women in the witch trials?
The modern moral of the tale of the young women in the witch trials is that being an adolescent girl is very hard. I have tremendous sympathy, I might go so far as to even say pity, for the afflicted girls. One of them, Anne Putnam, who is written out of the Crucible. Her name has changed. She's turned into a totally minor character. Anne Putnam accused more people who went to the gallows than anybody else. And she also is the only afflicted girl who later issued an apology. Mm. When she was in her 20s and she was still unmarried, she stood up and apologized. Her apology was read at meeting on Sunday.
What did she say?
I'm going to forget. I won't be able to quote it directly, but she essentially said that they had been deluded by Satan, that they had accused the wrong people. She didn't stop believing in witchcraft, I hasten to add. She didn't stop believing in the devil. She didn't stop believing that the invisible world had valence in her everyday life, but she came to confess that they had been deluded by Satan and that she wanted to lie in the dust. That I can quote directly. That she felt so badly about it, she wanted to lie in the dust.
Catherine, bring it home in some sense to the North Shore, but also to the incredible closeness, vibrancy of all of these issues, witch trials, Hawthorne, your own work, sin, punishment, secrecy, shame, a kind of eternal witness on everything we're doing, right and wrong. What is this witch saga all about in the end?
You know, I feel like Salem, and we return to it each year, especially around Halloween, because I think Halloween is a time of masking and misbehavior and indulgence, but it's kind of an invited and sanctified misbehavior in a way. And I think for that reason, we think about wickedness and we think about wicked things and we flirt with wickedness and with wicked things and we costume ourselves in wickedness. And yet in the corners of our consciousness or in the corners of our memory, we think about real wickedness. We're still afraid, I think, of real wickedness. And that's why costuming about it is so attractive. It gives us a sense of control. And so we return to Salem because Salem reminds us that wickedness is real, that good-hearted people following the law who are educated and who really mean well can, through the apparatus of the state, murder 19 people who did nothing wrong. It's a chilling fact. And that's why we can't let it go. We have to look at that wickedness and understand, or try to understand, what is fundamentally not understandable.
That was the novelist Catherine Howe. Marilyn Roach and Tad Baker, how do you understand what is not understandable? Marilyn?
Well, it shows human nature at its worst, and with the people who told the truth and the people who defended them at its best. And that sort of thing just keeps happening clothed with the different cultures and times that it happens in, so that it's not going to be, when it happens the next time or is happening now, it won't look like it did in Salem, but it's the same path, the road to hell being paved with good intentions, and everything goes wrong from there on.
Tad, please.
Sure. I mean, as we mentioned earlier, if you think about the 17th century where witches are real, where they can kill you, destroy your family. They want to annihilate your faith, eliminate your country. And they don't even have to be present to do it. They're recruiting converts amongst the discontented. And you don't know who they are. Mm. So how do you and the government stop them from destroying you? Well, if you swap the word witch for terrorist, I think you understand the kind of problem that we face today. And frankly, seems to me Salem, the reason it resonates so much with us today is because it basically challenges the whole idea of American exceptionalism, doesn't it?
Sure does.
I mean, as Catherine said,
it mocks it. I mean, it holds up an extreme case of it and says...
Right. Well, I mean, look at this. It's the first massive failure of the government to protect the innocent. And what does the governor do? He issues a publication ban after Cotton Mather's book comes up.
The gag rule. This is exactly. Important. The yeah. First cover-up in American history. He said, we're not going to talk about this.
That's right. For 3 years it lasted. And when it's broken, who breaks it? It's a Quaker. And, you know, people have the stereotype that everyone in Massachusetts were Puritan. But, in fact, if you listen to Hawthorne in the House of Seven Gables, he's talking about Quakers there, right? Matthew Maule, the character who is the wizard who is wronged.
Right.
Hawthorne names him very deliberately after Thomas Maule, the Salem Quaker, who's the man who breaks that publication ban after 3 years mm-hmm. and is punished severely for that. But initially, when he's tried, that's where the American dream comes true. He's found not guilty by a jury, including a man who'd been on the trial of the witches 3 years earlier and convicting mm-hmm. people. And he's found guilty in large parts and seen by American legal experts as the beginning of freedom of religion, freedom of press, freedom of speech. In America. So there is hope that comes out of this. But also, too, every generation, as Marilyn says, right?
Yep. They keep going down the wrong road. But it's not easy to see.
It is a generational story, Seven Gables. And am I right that the big moral in Hawthorne's vision is that it's sort of Shakespeare, you know, the good that men do is interred with their bones, but the evil lives after, regenerates, comes back and back generationally. It's never destroyed. It's never overcome. It's never transcended.
Well, that's the problem, isn't it? It's not a very uplifting note, but I say, unfortunately, as long as we have things like racism and bigotry and hatred and scapegoating, we're going to have some kind of witchcraft, aren't we?
Or something. You know, for me, the cure for all this is just to go home and read Hawthorne. I mean, there's a darkness in the man as well as the sheer beauty of his prose. It's everywhere. Here's a little tiny fragment from The Scarlet Letter. He writes, "It is a curious subject of observation and inquiry whether hatred and love be not the same thing at bottom. Each in its utmost development supposes a high degree of intimacy and heart knowledge. Each renders one individual dependent for the food of his affections and spiritual life upon another. Each leaves the passionate lover or the no less passionate hater forlorn and desolate by the withdrawal of his object." I mean, what didn't he understand about us? Melville dedicated Moby Dick to Hawthorne. He thought he was the Shakespeare of the American Renaissance. He was also probably the handsomest writer in American history and probably the happiest married man among in the literary crowd, don't we think?
Yeah, but at the same time, he was clearly haunted, wasn't he?
I think so. Enough to change the spelling of his name from the H-A-T-H. He put in a W to distinguish himself from the bad guy in the witch trials.
But there's a question about why he did that. He may have done that for just
historical reasons. Question about everything, Ted, right?
I know. But also, he wasn't the only one either to change their names. The nurses became Norses. The Gedneys became Gidneys.
Spelling was sort of up to you.
That's right. Spelling optional, yeah.
Isn't part of the beauty, as Catherine Howe is saying, though, that this legend is so close, so palpable to where we sit right now? And Cape Ann, I don't want to give it away, but it is so different from, shall we say, Cape Cod. Mm-hmm. So less commercial, less imprinted with great public works like the bridges and the canals and all that sort of stuff, and entirely recognizable from this history mm-hmm. and those stories, no?
It has its own feeling. It's not that touristy, except Salem in October, of course. But you can get the feel of what happened there.
What do you love about the North Shore, Tad?
Everything. It's just, I get the chills just walking the streets of Salem because I feel like I'm back in the 17th century. And the people come back and the scenes and the Hawthorne and the lines from the witch trials.
Should I mention Cranes Beach or the Ipswich Marshes or
Newburyport,
Gloucester?
Being in a place is part of exploring what happened there. You can get the feel of seeing somebody.
Is the Alamo that way? I've never been there. I've been there and I didn't feel a thing.
Well,
see, I can't imagine writing about the witch trials and not being in Salem.
You have to be on the ground, really.
It's a very powerful sense of place that'll never go away.
And you can get in a good swim on the same trip.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Tad Baker, Marilyn Roach, Stacy Schiff, and Catherine Howe. Thanks also to Terry Colgren and Stacy Tilney, the Salem Witch Museum. Our show this week was produced by the very spooky team of Max Larkin, Connor Gillies, Pat Tomeno, and Zach Goldhammer. George Hicks is our wizard at the controls. Mary McGrath is our witch in chief. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.